This is America's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It is public federal land. It belongs to all of us.
Environmentalists worry ANWR revenue will be part of the Republican tax plan. From Alaska Public Media, this is a statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, backers of a new plan for the Marine Highway System propose some dramatic changes.
I strongly suggest crafting legislation necessary to move this effort forward and create a public corporation that will take over governance of the system.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
Environmentalists are warning that the Republican plan to cut taxes could include a move that would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. A draft of the Senate budget plan for 2018 is likely to emerge next week. No one expects the document to mention the Arctic Refuge by name. Lydia Weiss of the Wilderness Society says she's concerned it will include vague instructions to the Senate Energy Committee to find several billion dollars in revenues.
There is no doubt that that is an invitation to Senator Murkowski to attach an Arctic Refuge drilling rider.
Lisa Murkowski chairs the Energy Committee. Opening the refuge to drilling is a top priority for her, as it's been for Alaska's congressional delegation for 40 years. Neither her office nor Senator Dan Sullivan's answered questions about the strategy today. Weiss and other environmentalists say ANWR doesn't belong in the budget.
Drilling in the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge is wildly unpopular and always has been across the lower 48. This is America's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It is public federal land. It belongs to all of us.
But ANWR could hold a lot of oil, and the idea of exploring it has a lot of support in Alaska. The Trump administration has revived hopes for development. The Interior Department is trying to allow 3D seismic work on the coastal plain. If ANWR is included in the 2018 budget reconciliation package, it would only need 50 votes to pass in the Senate, because that kind of bill can't be filibustered. Several Republican senators oppose ANWR drilling, along with nearly all the Democrats, so passage is not assured. Two Japanese naval destroyers are in Anchorage for a goodwill port call. The Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force has been traveling the world since May, making port calls in South America, Canada, along the East Coast, and even Pearl Harbor. About 500 sailors are on board both ships, but the six-month tour is primarily part of an effort to train 200 new cadets. The ships were docked in Homer earlier in the week before heading toward Anchorage. Sailors toured the VA hospital and observed military exercises at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The new cadets also plan to volunteer at a local food bank, and members of the Naval Band will perform a short concert at the Anchorage School District's Japanese Immersion Program tomorrow. Such visits from the Japanese Navy are not new. They happen every 4 to 5 years. The ships will be docked at the port of Anchorage for 3 days. A plan to reform the Alaska Marine Highway System calls for replacing some ferries with smaller, more efficient vessels. Backers want it to be run by an independent corporation and negotiate its own labor contracts. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
It's a windy afternoon in Lynn Canal, time for a safety drill on board the ferry Malaspina. Instructions blast over the PA system as crew members in orange float coats lower rescue boats over the side. There's no real emergency here, but on a larger scale, there is. Many Alaska Marine Highway ferries are showing signs of age. Fares are rising and sailings have become less frequent. Most importantly, funding is dropping, pointing to what could be dark times ahead.
We can continue to admire the problem and the resulting report, like has happened so many times in the past. Or we can do something.
Mark Lucan is commissioner of the State Department of Transportation, which includes the ferry system. He's speaking at the Southeast Conference annual meeting in Haines. And the report he's talking about, it's a near-final draft of a plan to change how the Marine Highway is managed and, in some cases, operated.
I strongly suggest crafting legislation necessary to move this effort forward and create a public corporation that will take over governance of the system.
The new corporation would continue to receive state and federal funds, but backers say it would provide a buffer between the ferry system and shifting political priorities.
It's not a complete divorce from state government.
Susan Bell is a former state commerce commissioner who's with the McDowell Group, which contributed to the report.
There's a lot of ways that the public has accountability. There's a lot of ways that other agencies like Department of Transportation, law, and administration can continue to support it.
The corporation would have its own staff, overseen by a 7-member board appointed by the governor. It's modeled, in part, on the Alaska Railroad Corporation. Another major change is how and when the system would be funded. Jim Calvin is senior economic analyst for the McDowell Group.
The reason that you want this sort of advanced planning opportunity, the forward funding that can support this advanced planning, is so that people can plan accordingly, particularly businesses that need long lead times to plan their business operations around the service that the Marine Highway can provide.
The state legislature would have to agree for the plan to work. That's been a difficult battle for the education budget, which has had much broader support.
Forward funding in a year in advance, and this budgetary climate, I think it's a bridge too far.
Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican, is skeptical. He says the whole reform plan could leave the ferry system open to deeper budget cuts. Representative Sam Keto, a Juneau Democrat, has a different take. He says he'll introduce legislation to forward fund the system. A third significant operational change is labor relations. Bell says the corporation would take over contract negotiations. That would allow it to change work rules, which could reduce staff and bring savings.
We think that the system would benefit from a more direct relationship between the Marine Highway governance and the unions. And we believe that not only the change to the corporate structure, but direct negotiations will enhance that.
We're not going to be helping the workforce.
Captain Joan Sizemore is a Marine pilot working in Southeast Alaska. The former ferry employee is concerned about the direction.
Seems to be that the impetus right now is to cut costs by removing people. And if you have fewer people working on those ferries, that's fewer dollars to spend in Alaska.
The ferry reform plan calls for the fleet to remain at 9 ships, the current number of active vessels. But two large ferries, the Columbia and the Kennecott, would be gone. Captain John Reeves of the Elliott Bay Design Group says some others would be replaced with simpler ships.
Some of the shorter routes, you don't necessarily need to have a crew on board 24/7 because the vessel is just making shorter runs. So if we can have a different vessel, has a smaller crew, it's cheaper to operate, but still provides the same service to the communities.
The ferry reform report also includes what it calls a minimal service model. That would reduce the fleet from 9 to 7 ships and the annual weeks of service by about 20%. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Haines.
Ketchikan has welcomed more than 1 million cruise ship visitors in a single season for the first time. The millionth visitor was honored on Monday. Fort Lauderdale, Florida resident Candy Borda was presented a custom sash by John Binkley, president of Cruise Line International Association Alaska. Binkley says 1 million visitors is just the beginning for Ketchikan. He says the growth in the city's cruise industry is exciting, and he looks forward to increases in the coming years. Binkley says on average, visitors to Ketchikan who come by way of cruise ships typically spend $159 while in town. Ketchikan's population is about 13,000, but that figure can more than double on certain days during the cruise season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, good news for Red King crab fishermen in Southeast.
We've seen a decrease in the early 2000s. It was fairly prolonged, but now we're seeing an increase.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The federal agency that manages Pacific walrus is scheduled to decide this week whether the animals should be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. A court settlement calls for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make a listing decision by the end of September, which is Saturday. The Center for Biological Diversity filed the listing petition in February 2008. Climate Science Director Shay Wolf says walrus's primary habitat, sea ice, has decreased by half in recent decades because of climate change. Climate models predict the loss will continue. The state of Alaska opposes the listing. State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale says the walrus population is robust and that projections of future sea ice melt are uncertain. Restrictions on king salmon sport fishing will be lifted soon for most of Southeast except Haines and Skagway. Sport fishing for king salmon in the region has been nearly non-existent for the last few months. Concerns over alarmingly low numbers prompted the shutdown of king salmon retention for sport and commercial fishermen in August. As KHNS's Abby Collins reports, conservation worries are still affecting northern Southeast Alaska.
Starting October 1st, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is reopening sport fishing for king salmon in most of Southeast Alaska. That means fishermen will soon be able to keep the fish they catch. For the last few months, they've had to return them to the water unharmed. In the Upper Lynn Canal, that's been the case all summer. Rich Chapel is an area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Haines. He says reopening the king salmon sport fishery shouldn't harm important fish populations.
Less than 5% of the annual sport harvest of king salmon happens after September and through March. So we're just returning to the regional regulations based on the abundance index under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And we just anticipate very few king salmon are going to be harvested during this winter fishery period.
After last season, 9 out of 11 king salmon systems in Southeast didn't meet their escapement goals. In initial escapement surveys taken in August, the department found production and productivity of kings was lower than anticipated. That prompted Fish and Game's unusual decision to shut down commercial and sport fishing for king salmon throughout Southeast. In the Haines and Skagway area, Chapel says those restrictions will stay in effect.
Chilkat kings are a little bit different than other Southeast king salmon stocks like the Taku River, because the Chilkat kings mainly stay in the inside waters of Northern Lynn Canal during the winter. Most of them don't go out to the Pacific Ocean to rear. Because of that concentration of Chilkat kings and because of the very low abundance of Chilkat kings we've seen in recent years, we're just being extra conservative here.
Looking ahead to 2018, Chapel says he expects restrictions to return to sport fisheries in Southeast.
Based on the extremely low returns to Southeast Alaska king salmon spawning areas, I expect that abundance index to be quite a bit lower and fishing regulations should be quite a bit more restrictive in all of Southeast Alaska next year.
But for now, starting October 1st, sport fishermen outside of the Upper Lynn Canal can try to harvest kings again. The resident bag and possession limit is 2 king salmon 28 inches or greater in length. For non-residents, it's 1 king salmon with a limit of 3 per year. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
Southeast Alaska will open to commercial fishing for red king crab this fall for the first time in 6 years. As KFSK's Angela Denning reports, the crab population has seen a steady increase, according to state surveys.
Red king crab are the largest shellfish in the state and can weigh up to 24 pounds and have a leg span of 5 feet. What commercial fishermen in Southeast haul in is smaller, usually around 8 to 9 pounds, but they are still worth a lot. Red king crab brought nearly $11 a pound during the last opening in 2011. So it's not unheard of to bring in a $100 crab. The last fishery was worth nearly $1.9 million at the dock. But whether the opening set for November 1st will be lucrative is still to be seen. Joe Stratman is Alaska Department of Fish and Game's lead crab biologist for Southeast. He says the red crab population has been on the rise since 2013.
Basically, for the last 4 or 5 seasons, we've seen improvement in legal mature biomass estimates in Southeast, And now they've gotten to the level where we reach this a harvestable surplus.
Fish and Game monitors the population through annual surveys where they catch and sample crab. They also work with local fishermen on a mark and recapture project. They track two groups of king crab, the legal biomass, or crab that are big enough to be harvested in the commercial fishery, and the mature biomass, which also includes crab that are sexually mature but not big enough to be landed. Stratman says both numbers look good this year.
These adjusted biomass estimates amount to a 40% increase in the legal male biomass and a 41% increase in mature male biomass from last season.
He says that's the largest increase in a few decades. The state can open Southeast commercial season if the estimated amount of legal size male king crab tops a harvestable surplus of at least 200,000 pounds. This year is just above that. Managers will be keeping close tabs on the fishery. They're splitting the region into six fishable areas. They will open for only 24 hours, then close for 4 days for sampling. Then two areas will reopen for a length of time that will be decided later by managers. 59 fishermen in Southeast have permits to participate in the fishery. KFSK contacted some of them in Petersburg. Nick Versteeg of Petersburg, who has been fishing his whole life, says the opening is short, but it's better than nothing. Craig Evans, who has been fishing in Petersburg for 40 years, says he was confused by the announcement. Says he's not sure how it's going to work with a 24-hour opening, then a closure, and then a reopening. Still, he says he's glad there is at least some kind of opportunity. Several other fishermen say they aren't happy with the opening, but didn't want to be interviewed. The population of Southeast's red king crab has been in flux, according to Fish and Game. Back in the 1990s and early 2000s, there were commercial openings nearly every year. But then there was a decline for about 12 years. The population was dropping about 7% annually, and then it started to rebound. Stratman says they aren't sure why the population has changed.
We know what we see in the survey, and we've seen a decrease in the early 2000s. It was fairly prolonged, but now we're seeing an increase.
This fall's commercial opening will allow fishing in more southern, non-traditional areas than in previous fisheries. Stratman says managers have created northern and southern non-surveyed areas with two separate harvest levels.
Based on what we've heard from the fleet, I think splitting it up this way, I think it'll allow for the time that they're looking for.
Fishermen can also take blue king crab in the fishery, but they are incidental catches, representing only about 1% of the king crab population in Southeast. The increased population of red crab is also allowing more liberalized bag limits for the personal use fishery outside of the Juneau area. Starting in November, the bag limit will increase from one crab a day to three or six, depending on the location. But red king crab aren't easy to get. They prefer deeper water, starting around 150 feet. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This week, we've been bringing you the voices of this year's Alaska Teacher of the Year finalists. There are four candidates, and the Department of Education will select the winner next month. Today, we'll hear from Karen Martin. She teaches fourth grade at Denali Burroughs Tri-Valley School. Martin has been a teacher for 12 years and was a scientist before she became a teacher. She says educational requirements for younger students have become more strenuous.
The expectation academically for what children are expected to learn, especially early on, is more rigorous than it was when I was younger. And I think, there's a shift. It kind of impacts the whole schedule for what a school day might look like for a younger child or even older child. Like, I know growing up I had three recesses. And now students in our building generally have one. more is expected of younger children learning to read earlier and the rigor of the content. And we're not saying that's a bad thing, but I think we have to be careful of a balance for a healthy life.
So let's talk about technology a little bit. You're teaching younger students, so maybe not as challenging as if you were in high school. Mm-hmm. But still, technology is everywhere. How does that change what you're doing in a classroom?
I think there's a lot of new skills that we need to be mindful of helping young students develop in this age of technology. And I think there's a lot of value that comes from integrating technology in the classroom in terms of not only how the skill set to help them use information on the internet or in other resources wisely or critically, but also it's a world that they understand that I don't necessarily. And there's things that they learn in ways that they communicate through technology that I can't shy away from just because it's not my world. Like, I think it's important to help them develop them into that because of that is their future.
Is it harder to get young children to pay attention for long periods of time? Do you see a change in attention span with students now?
I guess not necessarily. Not necessarily, because I think that some of our most important work is to help kids engage with whatever content, whatever information, whatever learning that we are designing for them, and that's part of our responsibility is to help them be engaged with that and help them take ownership of that learning and be responsible for their learning. And kids, it's fascinating to me, if you give them a choice sometimes of doing something with their hands or doing something with technology, they will choose to do something with their hands.
One of the things that you said was, I trust my students to be leaders in their own learning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
As a cohort of colleagues, we've been looking at how do we really allow students to do their own learning? How do we allow them, and when do we recognize that struggle is okay if it's productive? You know, do we need to sail in? And as teachers, we feel like that's what we do. We need to work, we're nurturers. We come in, we have the answer, we give it to them. But really what we do is we take away the learning. And so part of it is being more mindful of when they're working on their own, when they're working together, allowing them to do the learning, to do the work of learning. And then the other part is I try to, every opportunity I can, if there's a learning experience or a learning intention, to create an opportunity where the students together can find the solution to a problem. I don't, and like the converse of that would look like I stand at the board and I show them the algorithm or I show them the solution. Instead, I'll give them the problem and see if they come up with the strategies. And then when they do, because they do, then allow them to come up and teach each other.
Karen Martin is one of four finalists to be the next Alaska Teacher of the Year. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Eric Rush, a third grade teacher at Tickasuck Brown Elementary in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. The jet stream circles the globe from west to east, affecting weather, climate, and even the length of many airplane flights. This week on Ask a Climatologist, we're answering a question from a listener who asked how the jet stream affects weather in Alaska. Climatologist Brian Bretschneider spoke with Alaska's Energy Desk editor, Annie Feit. He says the jet stream is basically a ribbon of air circling the globe at high speed.
And it's generally the boundary between cold polar air and much warmer kind of mid-latitude or subtropical air. And so it's always present all year round, every year, but it varies in intensity quite a bit. And when it's not quite as cold in the summer months and in the fall months, it's in the vicinity of Alaska. In the heart of the winter, usually it's farther south, so it doesn't really affect us that much. But it's always there. So something that's of great interest to the weather, the climate community, to the aviation community. So a lot of people are focused on where the jet stream is, how it's moving, and what it's going to do over the next number of days.
But in Alaska, it doesn't affect us too much?
The jet stream does affect us here in Alaska, particularly in the fall and the spring months. We're kind of right at that boundary between where the cold polar air is and the much warmer air farther to the south. And as the jet stream, it moves like a ribbon. And so at times it goes up and at other times it goes down and has to stay in equilibrium. And so where it comes down, you actually spin up low pressure areas, and those then form precipitation and have wind. So we do, you know, we have these large fall storms and sometimes in the spring as well. Those are very frequently associated with these dips in the polar jet stream as they're situated near Alaska.
And how is climate change affecting the jet stream?
In the last few years, there's been a fair bit of research that's looked into this issue of what does a warming world do? What will it do to the jet stream? The strength of the jet stream is a function of the temperature difference between the high latitudes, the Arctic polar latitudes, and the equatorial or tropical latitudes. In a warming world, high latitudes warm faster. And so then that difference in temperatures is reduced, which then reduces the strength of the jet stream. So the jet stream in a weaker state is more susceptible to these wild gyrations. And so when you have this jet stream that's more susceptible to moving around, basically, in, say, the lower 48, you can get, paradoxically, more Arctic outbreaks, but then you can also get more dramatic warm-ups in the winter. So more variability and more storminess possible. So it's something that is kind of a new emerging area, and it makes sense from a physics point of view. And now the researchers are just trying to put that puzzle together and kind of confirm what they think the theory indicates.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. Thanks to listener Greg Streveler in Gustavus for sending in the jet stream question. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aaron Bolton in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Abby Collins in Haines, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Annie Feit in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.